Hi everyone and welcome to the Genomics Lab podcast, the podcast about current research in the field of genomics.
We are your hosts, Eleanor Watson and Olivia Grant, two PhD students in the genomics group at the University of Essex.
Join us as we speak to researchers in the field about their current research and their journey into genomics. Hello, we are back with another episode. Today's one I am very, very excited for. So we are talking about biomarkers. So you have most probably definitely heard the term biomarkers. I don't know about you as a listener, but for me, definitely like during my undergrad, I heard the term biomarker all the time and in many different areas of biomedical research. So pretty much in every single one of my modules in undergrad, like I heard this term biomarker. But I never really of course I knew what it was, but really interesting talk that we had today because I kind of got to ask like all of the questions that I guess I've wanted to ask since I've heard the term biomarker. So if you're unsure what a biomarker is, how exactly they're used, who they're aimed at, all of that good stuff, we are covering all of that in today's episode. And I am joined by the wonderful Dr. Paul Okunef from Dyakarta. So he is the founder and consultant at Dyakarta, which is a translational genomics and precision molecular diagnostics company. Paul is board certified in therapeutic radiology and is also among the pioneers of in vivo nuclear magnetic resonance imaging of tumors. That was a bit of a mouthful, actually. And he is now, he serves as the radiation oncology chair for the Southwest Oncology Group and is also a diplomat of the National Board of Medical Examiners, where he serves on national committees which oversee the safety and quality of therapeutic radiation delivery. Had a really interesting chat with Paul. Like I said, we're covering all things biomarkers. We talk about like how he got into this area of research, which you're probably going to be surprised at because I was as well. So actually kind of like stemmed from events like 9/11, which I thought was just super cool. And also we talk about like, you know, like the ethics behind biomarkers, what happens when insurance companies get a hold of these biomarkers, if they're developed as much as they potentially could be in the future, which I always think is such an interesting conversation. So stick around to hear his thoughts on that. And then of course we get into the science behind biomarkers, and more specifically, we are focusing on this paper that Paul was a co-author on, which was published in Nature Scientific Reports. And it covers the use of plasma cell-free DNA biomarkers for non-small cell lung cancer patients. So really interesting. He has some amazing insights and also really, really cool to speak to someone from industry. Obviously, normally I'm speaking to people from academia. So this is, you know, like PIs, postdocs and PhD students and all that good stuff. But it's nice sometimes just to like talk to other people who are also doing like really cool research, who are not necessarily within an academic institution. So yeah, I hope that you guys enjoy this. It's a little bit different, but yeah, Paul had so many great insights and I just really enjoyed speaking to someone from this really cool company like Dyakarta. So the links for Dyakarta, if you want to check out their website, you want to check them out on LinkedIn, they're all sort of like in the description box of the episode. So you can head there to find those. Other than that, I hope you guys enjoy this episode. As usual, make sure that you like give a rating, review, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at the Genomics Lab. So let's talk all about biomarkers in genomics. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Genomics Lab. So today I am delighted to be joined by Dr. Paul Okunef from Dyakarta. So welcome, Paul. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
My pleasure.
Nice to have you. Okay, so I always start by just asking all of my guests just to give an introduction to you and your background. I obviously have already given a brief introduction, but it's always nice to hear from you directly.
Yes, my name is Paul Okunef. I'm the chair of radiation oncology at the University of Florida and a researcher. I've been studying for most of my career methods to reduce normal tissue toxicity and or make tumor respond better to treatments. And in the process, have identified a number of biomarkers that can help identify whether treatments are working or whether they're just toxic.
Amazing, sounds really interesting. So Can you explain what exactly a biomarker is? I've spoke before, I've done sort of an episode on epigenetic biomarkers, but could you say, like, more, I guess, in like a broad sense, what exactly is a biomarker?
Yes. So biomarkers really come in a couple of categories, the ones that you measure in the blood and the ones that you measure directly off the tumor. So the ones you measure directly off the tumor are usually a one shot. They're usually done before any treatment starts. And sometimes they're used to decide whether or not statistically there could be an advantage to the, for example, chemotherapy or radiation, or whether the tumor will respond, say, to hormones, so estrogen receptors for breast cancers. Mm-hmm. Then there's the humoral ones, the ones you measure in the blood. And those are rather more limited. They're rarely quantitative. There are a number that are based on a number of biomarkers, for example, a number of RNA or DNA biomarkers, mm-hmm. But they can't be quantitative usually when you do a panel, because you're not actually measuring how much, you're measuring whether it's there or not. There's efforts to use these panels, for example, therefore for screening, especially for tumors that have very reliable mutational patterns. Mm-hmm. There aren't really any yet, however, that can personally measure whether a given chemotherapy treatment is actual or not during the course of treatment, that is cycle by cycle. So that at some point, we have to know whether to stop the chemo because it's no longer working, just causing toxicity. And that's a big problem in medicine right now, especially since we have many more targeted drugs that could be tried. And it's unhelpful if we end up burning up a patient's resilience before you get to try the new drugs.
Yeah, that was a great explanation. I've got two questions just off the back of that. And the first one is probably a more general question, which is, for those who are listening who maybe this is the first time that they've heard about the term biomarker, you've, I guess, sort of touched on it, but what exactly do we need biomarkers for? In other words, how exactly do biomarkers actually help sort of in medicine?
Yeah, Olivia, that's a great question. So for example, an obvious one that I think many people are familiar with are PSA, that is prostate-specific antigen for prostate cancer. It's one of our very best, mm-hmm. because only the prostate makes PSA. No other mm-hmm. organ makes it. And so when you measure it in the blood, you're measuring cell turnover. And if it goes up, the tumor's growing. And if it goes down, it's shrinking. And it's almost ubiquitously present whenever anybody has prostate cancer, or frankly, as long as they have a prostate, but then it's in normal levels. Mm-hmm. So you can measure the size, if you will, of the prostate or the turnover rate of the prostate with that biomarker. Mm-hmm. That's one that everybody knows. Breast cancer is one where the biomarkers are right on the tumor. So you know that if a person has estrogen receptors or progesterone receptors on their tumor, particularly a large number of them, they are going to have an excellent response to hormonal therapy and probably don't need chemo. Mm-hmm. In fact, probably outperform any chemo is the hormone receptors. So biomarkers can sometimes help us a lot for either following the rate of tumor growth or shrinkage, the PSA was the example, or helping us to identify a correct treatment, the receptors being the example there.
Yeah, that makes sense. Does this sort of, so the first sort of question that I asked, you mentioned this term quantitative and about how some were quantitative and some weren't.
Right.
Is this something, so what exactly do we mean by the term quantitative? Is that what you mean by sort of measuring?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And you've hit really on an important topic. So the PSA itself is quantitative. The half-life of PSA in the blood can be quite long, so mm-hmm. it's not very rapidly acting, so you don't know necessarily fast enough if mm-hmm. it's working. So that's an issue with it, but it is a quantitative biomarker because the ELISA that's used to calibrate it has been extremely well standardized. Very few ELISAs are that well standardized. Mm-hmm. There are a couple other tumor markers in that category that are mostly protein tumor markers. Then you have the, if you will, the advanced molecular tumor markers. Most of them, not all of them, and there are some in development by a number of labs around the world, trying to be more quantitative, but mostly they're a mixture of biomarkers. So there's an equation, linear or otherwise, that takes a number of important genes, adds them and subtracts them from each other, takes ratios, and then comes up with a score. Mm-hmm. And the score then determines the chances that the tumor is in the blood, for example, on a blood test, or the chances that the tumor is going to need chemotherapy in a population of patients. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, though, once you try and find single mutations from the tumor in the blood, you end up having to literally examine many 50, 100, 200 nanograms, every bit of that DNA to look for that mutation because it's so rare. Yeah. So that's why you need panels and you need to know a lot about the tumor for them to work well. Mm-hmm. They're not quantitative though, because the equation is just really mostly a probability of tumor in the blood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes complete sense. So in terms of sort of your career, I guess, or your research, are you interested in specific diseases? Is there any sort of specific diseases or cancers that you are interested in?
I've studied a lot about, over the years, sarcomas and breast cancer, but the truth is I'm interested in a lot of different kinds of tumors, and more recently I've been focusing on the aerodigestive tumors, smoking-related cancers, and diseases in that category.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So when you're looking at smoking-related cancers, do you find that the biomarkers, maybe this is a stupid question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you find that the biomarkers are the same for all sort of smoking-related cancers? Or like, is there sort of one common biomarker for that? Or is it like, is there a different biomarker for different cancers, if that makes sense?
Yeah, so both sides of your question are yes. Okay. That is, are there specific biomarkers for specific cancers? Yes. Mm-hmm. And are there general ones? Mm-hmm. And that's what we believe we've done in the paper that is under discussion today, is develop a marker that's more general. Mm-hmm. When a marker is more general, it's, if you will, also less specific, because that's a necessity for something to be more general.
Yeah.
And so it has its strengths and weaknesses, but it appears to be far more quantitative because it's a very simple, mechanistically understandable biomarker that doesn't require an equation, an algorithm, and very special reagents and equipment to make the measurements, or the equation becomes invalid. Mm-hmm. So we believe that it's something that physicians will want to use as a LDT test, a regular test that we do, in vitro IVD test, that we regularly do for a lot of diseases. You know, if we want to know if somebody's got diabetes, we measure sugar. If we want to know if somebody's got renal failure, we measure their creatinine. Mm-hmm. And this would be a biomarker to know whether they're responding to their chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. And arguably would work in most metastatic disease settings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see how that would be super, super useful. So can you tell me then a little bit, I know you mentioned this paper, can you tell me a little bit about this biomarker, or maybe first sort of what were the motivations for, I guess, making this biomarker? I guess you've kind of just touched on them a little bit there, but what were your sort of personal motivations for wanting to get involved in the research?
Yeah, so it's a long story, and I guess we have a few minutes, so I'll describe it. So back 9/11, of course, the world realized that it didn't have ways to manage malevolent or natural disasters of various sorts. And so the US government realized that they didn't know how to evaluate, in case of a nuclear exposure, whether or not people had been exposed or not. because the treatments were dangerous.
Interesting. I wasn't expecting you to say something like this. It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So the goal was to do that. And the idea there is they needed to be able to know who was a worried well and just go home and they were fine. They weren't radiated or they didn't get very much. Mm-hmm. Who got a little bit of radiation, give them some antibiotics, send them home. Who is sick enough that they can be saved and therefore you need to take resources and use them to save them. And who is, forgive the term, walking dead. Mm-hmm. That is clergy. And so that was an important consideration. And so they wanted a test to do that. And it occurred to us that, and there wasn't a test that worked for that. There, yeah. Believe it or not, there wasn't one. And so it occurred to us that one thing that happens when you radiate is you get a synchronized apoptotic burst within a few hours of the exposure, and that is dose response burst. So we decided to look for DNA in the blood. And that's how we started our research. And in that technology, looking at a number of different animal models, we did show a very good dose response relationship with the amount of circulating free DNA in the circulation over the first week or so after the exposure and the radiation dose. And then, of course, it peaked at the dose that was lethal. So if you exceeded the lethal dose, you can't kill the cells twice. So the mechanism of this test is very obvious. You take cells that are prone to apoptosis and you radiate them, and then you measure the DNA in the blood, and that tells you what the dose is. And you know that the next morning.
Interesting. So just a quick question on that. Sorry if I'm interrupting you. You mentioned there I can never say this word. It's always in tongue twister for me. Sorry. Apoptotic burst. Sorry, you know what I'm trying to say, don't you?
Yeah,
you know,
you said it.
Those words that just don't come out of your mouth right. This is always one of them. Whenever I have to say it, I'm like, apoptotic. See, it just doesn't come out.
Apoptosis.
Thank you. Apoptosis burst. So then you went on to talk about cell-free DNA. So can we talk about how those two things are related? So what exactly is cell-free DNA? And then you've hinted a little bit about how it comes about.
Yes. So cell-free DNA is the DNA we all have circulating in our blood all the time, because when a cell dies, it leaks its contents. And that occurs even with apoptosis. It's a little more organized, but the DNA ends up in the circulation. And the DNA from cells that are turning over faster will obviously dominate in the total DNA in the blood. So a cell that dies each cell will release a certain amount of DNA in the blood. There's as much as 6 picograms, a little bit more if you're female, and that it can release into the blood. So if you can actually measure that DNA before it clears, and the halftime of clearance is something like, depending on the type of DNA, up to a day, but usually more like 6 to 12 hours.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's quite surprising to me actually that you say that, because for example, going back to your paper, you're obviously, you know, you talk about a biomarker based off of cell-free DNA, if I'm correct, which what you've just mentioned about the half-life kind of surprises me, because if you wanted to use a biomarker based off of cell-free DNA for cancer detection, is the half-life ever then an issue? Does that make sense?
Great question, Olivia. Yeah, so we'll go back to the PSA issue, okay? PSA has not been used to determine response to chemotherapy, particularly between cycles. As you know, we use chemotherapy mostly for metastatic prostate cancer. And it's not been used for that, in part because it's been decided to be unreliable for that purpose. And the reason is the half-life.
Yeah.
So if you have an extremely successful drug that really kills the prostate cancer, it will briefly raise the PSA and it might stay elevated for a week or more. Mm-hmm. So if you measured then, you'd think the tumor grew.
Yeah.
If you wait long enough, then it goes down. So we don't measure it between cycles, we measure it between courses. Okay. But we measure it at long, you know, 3-6 month intervals, mm-hmm. Instead of over short courses, because then it becomes more reliable because it's settled down to a lower number. Mm-hmm. If you have a biomarker that has a too fast half-life, you never measure the pulse. So you want something that decays over a few days, mm-hmm. so that by the time you make your measurement, it's already down to its new low. Mm-hmm. But it's still quantitatively accurate.
Yeah, that makes sense. So is it, so the way you just spoke about it to me sort of sounds like it's good for measuring, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's good for measuring response to treatment.
Yeah, so that's what we used it for. You can add response to getting radiation exposure, which was one of the examples, right?
Yeah.
That was a whole body exposure. For the purpose of chemotherapy, the dominant source of circulating free DNA is the tumor, not the normal tissue. Because mm-hmm. it's the tissue that's turning over the fastest and is necrosing and apoptosing. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, when we have a patient with metastatic cancer, therefore has a reasonable metastatic burden, free DNA is dominantly from their tumor. And very simply, you can use a marker that you understand quite well, mechanistically, identify whether or not the chemotherapy worked with a half-life of the biomarker that allows it to be detected accurately and quantitatively mm-hmm. Before and after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really, really clever. That is clever. So is, again, sorry if I'm being silly. Does anyone use cell-free DNA biomarkers for detection of cancer then?
Yes. I mean, yes and no. The markers that are out there are primarily in development. I'm not sure how many, if any of them, are actually fully FDA approved. Mm-hmm. But there are tests that are used for screening, for example.
Yeah.
So yeah. If you have a high risk population for lung cancer or a high risk population for colon cancer, where the gene mutations are fairly well known, mm-hmm. there are people putting together panels. Mm-hmm. And then when they put the panel together, as I said, it comes out with an equation. So it says 10% chance that we'll find a tumor on a colonoscopy if we look. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, or 70% chance we'll find a tumor in a colonoscopy if we look.
Yeah.
So there are tests like that. Mm-hmm. And for certain cancers like colon cancer and lung cancer, where the genetic panels that are associated with malignant transformation are better known, mm-hmm. It's easier to make these panels. But usually these panels are extremely difficult to make because you really don't know which mutation the person's going to have, especially since you're often looking for a driver mutation. And tumors have very few driver mutations.
Yeah.
I think probably like 80% of tumors have 1, 2, or 3 driver mutations. So trying to find 3 mutations from a one gram tumor.
Yeah.
Doing screening in the whole patient's body, mm-hmm. Is, you can imagine, needle in a haystack.
Yeah, definitely. And so if you were looking for, so when you say when you're looking for these genetic mutations, so let's say you were looking at a particular cancer, which let's just say for argument's sake, you knew that it had one particular driving mutation. Do you actually have to take directly from the tumor itself?
Like, if that would be a tumor-based biomarker, right? But
yeah,
when you're trying to do screening or you're trying to evaluate between cycles, mm-hmm. then you would have to know that mutation was there, mm-hmm. or you'd have to have an assay that can overcome some of that difficulty and evaluate a lot of DNA from the blood, because you have to have that piece of DNA there or you can't detect it.
Yeah. Because I was just thinking about, when I mentioned at the start about how we did an episode on epigenetic biomarkers, I was just thinking, like, when you were talking there about, obviously, if you are taking a tumor-based biomarker, it must be quite difficult, depending, obviously, on where the tumor is in the body.
So that's a wonderful question. It's a nice lead-in. So another product that we've developed at Diacarta is a product we call Coloscape. But the point there is it uses a xenoDNA, where the nucleic acids are bound together by an amino-containing compound instead of phosphates. Mm-hmm. And so you can imagine it's got a slight positive charge.
Okay, sorry, can I interrupt for a second? Did you just say xenoDNA?
Xeno.
I've never heard of this.
Well, xenoDNA is DNA, but you fake it. You put fake bases in, for example, might be promiscuous. Or you put a different backbone on it, which is what we did. Okay. And our backbone is very stiff. Mm-hmm. But it has the exact same turning radius as real DNA. It also has a positive charge on the backbone instead of a phosphate, which means once it binds, it will not come off.
Okay, interesting. Okay. I've never heard of that before.
And we make it short enough that if there's even a single base error, because it's stiff, it cannot get close enough and it never binds. Mm-hmm. Then we make that xenoDNA against the wild type. So when we do that, we can do an amazing thing. We can quantitatively count how many point mutants, I'll say that again, we guarantee 1 to 10,000, but we can do it 1 to 100,000. So if you put one point mutant in a background of 100,000 wild type, we'll tell you there was one. Mm-hmm. Okay. If you put 10 in, we'll tell you there's 10 plus or minus 3. You know, it's just plus on. Mm-hmm. So the technique can detect that. And for colon cancer, as an example, the sequence of mutations that take a normal mucosa into a polyp or a advanced adenoma, mm-hmm. And what takes an advanced adenoma to a pre-malignant, pre-invasive tumor, and then what mutations take it into a cancer. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those mutations have been well mapped. The gene pathways are fairly well known. Mm-hmm. So for that, we made wild type clamps, xenoDNAs, for the locations where the point mutants are usually located.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then we're able to actually quantitatively count, for a little harder to do in screening, because there's probably not very many. Again, you have a 1 centimeter polyp, a 0.5 gram tumor in a sea of DNA. But if you have, you're needed, and we need about 10 nanograms. We'd like to get a little bit more, but at 50 nanograms, we can fairly reliably tell you whether it's there or not. And we've even proven we've actually identified the polyp more than once by sequencing it to prove the point mutation is what we thought it was.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's really cool. I've never heard of this xenoDNA. I've never heard about it.
Yeah, so we're testing it now in Italy. It's being tested now more comprehensive in Italy.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. Sounds really, really cool. So who are these? So this particular one that you've just spoke about, who are they actually like aimed at, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that's a great question too. So in the United States, if you're 45 years old, you get a colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. A colonoscopy is a pretty aggressive procedure.
Yeah.
I think in most of England, they also do them when you're 50.
Yeah.
And in most of Germany, they do them when you're 50. Mm-hmm. But most other European countries, and for sure the rest of the world, don't consider that a screening test. It's just too invasive. They consider it a diagnostic test. Mm-hmm. So, and the screening test is stool blood. Mm-hmm. So you look for stool blood. Now, stool blood will already get 20% of the advanced adenomas, which is really what you're looking for. Because once it's a cancer, arguably, you know, wish you, it's good to find it early, but you wish you found it before it got there, right?
Yeah, of course.
So, what you really want to do is get the advanced adenomas. So what we were able to show is we were able to show that we were getting about 60% of the adenomas in our preliminary study with this test.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
And there is a test that you might have heard called Cologuard, distinct from Coloscape, which is a test that's got a lot of popularity in the United States. It gets about 40% of the advanced adenomas, half by the FIT test, that is the blood test that's internal to it, and then half by some methylations. It looks primarily at the RAS gene, which is one of the latter genes in the process. So it's quite good at detecting tumors. It gets almost all of those, but it's weaker at getting the adenomas.
Mm-hmm. So when you say it's one of the latter genes, you mean it's like
the invasion and metastasis genes, right?
Yeah, right. Okay, got you.
It's the rest.
Mm-hmm. So can I ask a question? I'm sorry if this is a bit too this isn't a personal question at all, but so whenever I hear people talking about these kind of tests and these kind of biomarkers, I always think, oh my God, these are absolutely amazing. Like, obviously it would be ideal if these were used for screening rather than these diagnostic tests that you're talking about. But two things I always think about is, number one, how realistic is it that these can be used as screening tests for let's say everyone over the age of 40 in the US? And I ask it, number one, my first thing is I always think about cost.
Right. So that's another place where this is extraordinarily strong, because as you can see, there was no deep gene sequencing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was no deep gene sequencing. There was no DNA. There were no complicated series. I mean, but it's just these xenoDNAs and an admix, which can be multiplexed.
Mm-hmm.
And you look for if anything grows out.
Yeah.
Because the wild type won't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
it's a much simpler screen, and mm-hmm. therefore one that could be done realistically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how a company charges for things, that's one thing.
Yeah.
But certain tests, and I don't want to pick on Cologuard too much, but it's very hard for them to deploy that test because it requires the test to be done in a very, very specific way or the equation falls through. So it gets caught in time,
right,
that it can't add new technologies, for example. Mm-hmm. And they, for example, it's my understanding, have had trouble advancing to some of their efforts that they tried to reestablish their technique at another facility to increase their output of specimens. So I think right now in the United States, pretty much all the specimens are sent to Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it can't be deployed to labs everywhere, whereas the xenoDNAs can.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I guess that's the idea, isn't it? You want it to be sort of low cost, also sort of easy for everyone involved, I guess, as easy as it can be. Otherwise, it's just not going to be a successful screening program, is it?
And it's going to have a lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then my other one was, I always think about, so maybe it's not so applicable in this case, but earlier when you were speaking about, when I asked you about sort of the motivations for like how you got involved in this research, and you mentioned about this exposure to radiation thing.
Mm-hmm.
So another really interesting conversation that we had on the last one, again, where we were talking about the biomarkers, was the whole sort of thing about like ethical considerations. So I appreciate it's not like completely related to what we were just thinking about, but I would just love to hear your thoughts on.
Yes, I love it. I love it. So again, I apologize for picking on Coloscape, Cologuard. But problematically, almost all of the tests, these biomarker tests, particularly the ones that have an equation, are done in a specific population. Mm-hmm. That is the population that got selected. So in the example of Cologuard, the equation was optimized for white people.
Yeah.
So the equations don't work very well in their own data for Black people. Mm-hmm. In fact, they hardly work better than just the FIT test, that is the stool blood test, if you look at their data. Mm-hmm. And again, that's my interpretation, so I apologize for it. But it's much better to have a test that is race independent, mm-hmm. or that you understand the phenomena, so it's race and underlying disease determinable. Mm-hmm. So if you have a biomarker that is also up in liver disease, then you know better than to assume that person has cancer.
Yeah.
Right? You once you ascertain they don't have liver disease, then you're more comfortable. Mm-hmm. Right? And so that's where, for example, our circulating free DNA comes in, is that the mechanism is actually race independent. There's no way there's a race specificity to it.
Mm-hmm. Wow, yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, because I feel like there's, and rightly so, I mean, there's so many, and it's great that there's so many conversations coming up about you know, what role, like, you know, race plays in these things. I think that's so important that people sort of remember that. Can you sort of maybe, if you can, no worries, if you can't, but briefly touch on like why exactly race matters in the one that's not the cell-free DNA?
Fair enough. So I can't answer the reason because I don't think they know or we know, but I'll just remind you that you mentioned epigenetics. Mm-hmm. Okay. So epigenetics could potentially be different by race. Mm-hmm. It could be different by diet. Mm-hmm. The diet can change microbiome. So if you're measuring it in the stool, it could be different by microbiome. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's 100 ways it could be different. You know, the what I find exciting about the epigenetics is that if the mutation is due to having or not having a methylation, it's a reversible mutation in theory, which is kind of cool if it pans out. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to know whether the methylations came first or the mutations came first. Yeah. I know there's a lot of argument about which one came first. I'm not sure it even matters because really what happened first was a proliferative advantage. Mm-hmm. And once that happened, the rest of the items were potentially possible. I'm in my own mind, a gene guy. I believe they came first, but I accept that they're alternative and that breast cancer, for example, is probably different. Probably that's an expression disease. Mm-hmm. It's too many receptors and some of them are leaky and so you can't turn them off. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's a lot of, you know, you just make the receptor a little leaky and you can't turn it off anymore. You know, it just has to stop paying attention to the mm-hmm. The hormone regulation. So I think there's a combination of those, and all of those things can change in some of these formulations by race. You can see, or race or ethnicity. So it might even, or habits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting you say as well about epigenetics because, I was reading this paper actually, and they were looking at cardiovascular disease and they actually showed that like the DNA methylation profiles across like different races actually differed in relation to cardiovascular disease. So, I mean, again, that's really relevant for, I don't know, if you were, you know, like you said, if you were looking at biomarkers or epigenetic biomarkers for cardiovascular disease, because with epigenetic ones, I always think they're very, very cool. And I study epigenetics, so I love epigenetics, but I think they're really, really cool. But number one, I think the problem is that they're so expensive. And also then, you know, like there's just, like you said, there's so many other things that come into it. Like,
and you can also measure a blood lipids and blood cholesterol, right? So mm-hmm. which one came first? You know, there's always that discussion, right?
Yeah.
Did the cholesterol cause the epigenetics, or did the epigenetics cause the cholesterol? Yeah. Or both.
Yeah.
So I think, we're always going to have these circles because everything's a feedback. And that's why it matters. I mean, that's why race matters. There's a lot of other reasons race could matter. People have different SNPs for their different receptors, right? So a drug that's meant to inhibit a DNA repair enzyme, I'll just say Gemzar, for example, okay, gemcitabine, might not work as well as a modification of that very same molecule that maybe the company even owns the patent for, might work better in blacks, but it wasn't tested in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've never thought about that as well. That's interesting. What about as well, what we were talking about? I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as well. So going back to the whole thing about general biomarkers, what are your thoughts on, so I know a lot of people are really, really scared about like general sort of biomarkers for reasons of like, now I personally don't think it's ever going to get to this point, but I still think the conversation is always really, really interesting to have and hear other people's thoughts. Is what are your thoughts on? So I know a lot of people are scared about them for the reasons of like, what if, I don't know, one day there's like a biomarker and it can like, I don't know, to tell you you're going to get this in a couple of years, you're more likely to get this, blah, blah, blah. And insurance companies like getting hold of this. So we always have conversations about this. What are your thoughts on it? Do you think that biomarkers right. sort of get to the state where they're used in that sense?
Question, and it's been it's one that's never going to be fully satisfactorily answered. It's one where the answer is always both, and so those kinds of questions, we love them. God can make a rock that's too hard to lift and then he can lift it, and so it's wonderful to discuss those things. So the issue, of course, of what an insurance company is going to do is what an insurance company is going to do. But I'll remind you, they already know if your parents had diabetes. If you knew you weren't going to get it because you didn't inherit that disease, that would be the opposite. Okay. Otherwise, so all of these risk factors, they're already there. You already know if the family has a lot of cancer, but if you don't have BRCA, then at least you're not going to, that's not going to be the cause of your breast cancer if you get breast cancer. And that you don't need increased screening. The one thing that it does do, that is, if you know these genetic biomarkers, it helps you a lot because it knows whether you need more screening or you need to start screening at a younger age.
Yeah, true.
So it actually could reduce your chances of morbidity. Now, insurance companies also don't want you to live forever ever either, right? Because it costs them money if you live too long, right? So you can, I can't answer what insurance companies will do.
Yeah.
I can just say that knowledge isn't bad, and the way people deal with knowledge has to be better understood. It's still a bizarre question why people don't want to get the vaccine.
I know.
So people don't always like to believe in science, but it doesn't mean that, Einstein had this wonderful thing. He says, if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, they call that insanity. So we should like the fact that we know this.
No, that's so interesting because I've asked a lot of people that question and everyone always says like basically the opposite. So I've never thought about it the way that you've just said it. And also I think as well, because anyone I've ever spoken to about this, obviously we're all from the UK, none of us really have health insurance. So like this is something that we don't think about it.
Yeah,
so.
Well, I guess increased screening would end up costing the government more money. And since you've got a finite budget, there might be some disadvantages. But I would argue that having to treat a cancer is far more expensive than detecting it.
Yes.
And yeah. I think the cost of a unsuccessfully cured cancer are enormously higher than a cured cancer.
Yeah.
So I think all of these items, namely knowing screening for cancer using biomarkers, but also knowing if the treatment is working or not using biomarkers, is going to advantage the total cost.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because I think as well, if you're screening, I guess, for how well a treatment is working, I think as well, it's more likely to, like, let's say, I don't know, one treatment wasn't working as well as everyone thought it was, but without, you know, screening it as much as you should be, it's something that you might not pick up on. That could potentially push the government or, you know, it could potentially push them to give more funding towards that area of research as well.
Yeah, you know? I think I know what you're saying. So if you, and I agree, if you knew earlier that a treatment was not working, you wouldn't have to spend money on additional cycles of it. You could move to some other treatment.
Yes, yeah.
And when you ran out of things to treat with that were working, you wouldn't keep torturing the patient with treatments that weren't working, probably shortening their lives, not lengthening it. Mm-hmm. And you'd go more to a palliative mode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Or, yeah, that's exactly what I mean. And yeah, just help, I guess, encourage the government, yeah, to put more funding where funding should be going, because...
The biomarkers, yeah. So that you could actually know if something was working real time on a personalized level. I mean, that's the big difference that's the big difference between having a real-time test that's personalized and having a population test, like for example, this population of patients based on tumor markers will benefit 70% of the time from chemotherapy. It still means that 30% won't.
Yeah.
And so knowing if you're in that 30%, after you've also already started it.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, breast cancer has so many different targeted and non-targeted therapy options that work. Mm-hmm. So knowing earlier whether you need to switch is useful.
Yeah, exactly. You put it in a lot better words than I did, but yeah, that's what I mean. But I think it's that word personalized as well is, I don't know about, probably not for you, but for me, whenever I hear that word personalized, I always associate that with cost as well. But I guess that's a nice reminder that it doesn't have to be, but just whenever I hear personalized medicine, yeah. And I know this is really bad, but my first thoughts are always like, I kind of not dislike hearing about it, but I kind of do, because I'm like, is it ever really going to be a thing? You know, personalized medicine. I mean, it'd be great if it was.
Yeah, so personalized medicine becomes reasonable when the personalization is inexpensive. So deep gene sequencing is not inexpensive. Maybe one day it will be, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not fast enough.
Yeah.
To use between cycles of a chemotherapy, you need to know your answer too quickly.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Right. So doing that in a personalized way would be enormously expensive, the time constraints and everything that I've just discussed. Mm-hmm. So you really need a test that is easily interpreted.
Yeah.
So for example, if you're measuring cfDNA and the patient just got into a car accident and it was high, it doesn't mean the tumor didn't respond. You'd understand that that was probably a false positive.
Yeah.
Whereas it'd be much harder to know after a car accident if the reason you detected that abnormality had nothing to do with the tumor, with the equations, I mean. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes complete sense. Yeah. Oh, very, yeah. Really interesting. Really, really interesting. Cause yeah, like I said, I've always sort of heard the complete opposite opinions on these things. So yeah, really, really interesting.
We've been interested in making tests as much as possible that are deployable to third world countries or countries that have an inadequate or more limited medical infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about both the test, the cfDNA test for personalized detection of chemotherapy response in metastatic disease, and also the screening test, which is basically a single PCR reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those, I'm sorry, it's not even a PCR reaction. It's a vDNA reaction for the tumor response. And then for the colon cancer screening, for example. And lung cancer is another one that we, by the way, also have a panel for lung cancer screening. It's just a single PCR reaction. So I would argue it's much less expensive and difficult to interpret than, for example, CT scans are, which are used in both of our countries for smokers.
CT scans are used for smokers, are they?
Yes, so people who have more than 20 pack years. Yeah, so people who have more than 20 pack years smokers, they get a CT scan and there's always abnormalities on it. So then they got to get another CT scan. And if it's bigger, then they get a third CT scan. And if it's bigger still, then they biopsy. And you can imagine that this is a, the CT is the gold standard, but the gold standard isn't gold. It's dependent on the reader. And so so having a analytical test to go with it would be very helpful for, and especially one that's quantitative. Because then you can say, well, the image got bigger and the test went up, or the test went up, maybe we should do a scan to look for the, you know, if you want to do it in that order. I would say colonoscopies have to be a bigger burden on society than, even if they're done only 5 years apart, okay, than doing a annual blood test would be. And maybe that's even got better resolution for when you got the cancer.
Yeah, so this is kind of what I was trying to say earlier, but I didn't say it very well, is sometimes I wonder if, like, I sometimes wonder if, like, I don't know if it's the right way to say it, but whatever, if, like, the government kind of actually monitor, like, the costs associated with these things, and sometimes if they sort of realize that if they just put more funding towards things like development of biomarkers and things like that, if, because I think that would be like more cost effective and just more effective in general in the long run, you know?
I agree with that. I won't argue with that. I think in the long run, it is the way to go. And they have to be validated in multiple races, ethnicities, economic categories, because they won't be the same for everybody. And they won't be just as effective for everybody.
Yeah, I agree, yeah. Well, yeah, it's been really interesting. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Like I said, it was really nice to get some different opinions on these things. So to wrap up, could you sort of just, if anyone wants to contact you or they want to find out more about these, like anything that we spoke about today, is there a particular website or anything that they can go to find out any extra information?
Sure, sure. Diacarta's website is diacarta.com. And you can get a lot of information there. If you wanted to, for example, order a specific xenoDNA, or if you wanted to deploy the cfDNA test in your laboratory so that you had a CE mark test that is highly quantitative for the amount of DNA in the blood, you don't need a DNA purification test step for our assay, because that alone adds a lot of inaccuracy in terms of quantification of the circulating DNA. So you don't need it for our test because it doesn't use PCR. And you can get more information on both of those tests. You can get an update on the studies that we've completed. For example, I mentioned lung cancer, but we also have gastric cancer. We also have prostate cancer. And those are at the website.
Amazing. Cool. Thank you so much. I'll pop all of that in the description box below so people have easy access to it. But yeah, so all that's left to say is thank you so much again for talking to me.
It's nice. It was fun meeting you, Olivia.
Thank you for joining us for this episode.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter at The Genomics Lab. That's got a capital G and a capital L.
You can actually also find both of us on Instagram at a genomics PhD and at PhD_Ellie.
Finally, be sure to subscribe to us on your favourite podcast platform, and we will see you all in the next episode. Thank you again for listening.